The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Can you help me, please? I've had a problem with my health for years and I can't get to the bottom of it. The doctors have run out of ideas.
I'd love to help. My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session.
Right, can you book me in, please?
For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
If only I'd found out about you sooner, it would have made so much difference.
You're listening to UK Health Radio. Welcome to the Therapy Suite. I'm Duncan Ellison, a therapeutic counsellor with a focus on positive mental health. This week in the headlines, the Samaritans and Network Rail team up to prevent suicide on the UK rail network. And the NHS cracks down on out-of-area referrals. These stories and more coming up. This week, we'll also be looking at PTSD and a few unusual therapeutic tools. And in the Toolbox Talk this week, we'll take a different look at the five stages of grief. Music on the way from Lou Rawls and the Hollies, and wise words to reflect on. So if good mental health matters to you, then this show is not to be missed. Join me, Duncan Ellison, as we open the doors to the Therapy Suite, only on UK Health Radio. Mental health news making the headlines this week. The Samaritans have launched a campaign urging commuters using the UK rail network to make small talk to prevent railway suicides. Small Talk Saves Lives aims to give the public confidence to trust their instincts and to take action if they see someone who may be at risk. The campaign, which is in conjunction with the British Transport Police, Network Rail and the regional train operators, promotes a message that suicidal thoughts can be temporary and interrupted by a simple question. 5,000 commuters took part in a survey which revealed the majority were willing to help and prevent a suicide, with more than 4 out of 5 passengers happy to approach someone if they know what signs to look out for. According to statistics released by the Office of Rail and Road, 273 people died in suicides on the British rail network in the last 12 months. The NSPCC has called UK ministers to press social media sites to do more to protect children from online abuse after it was revealed counselling for cyberbullying has doubled in 5 years. Children as young as 9 are contacting NSPCC's Childline, having been troubled by name-calling, blackmail and death threats through online bullying which has been posted publicly on social media profiles and blogs. In one case, a boy told Childline that he was being bullied on social media sites by people calling him fat and ugly. According to a Childline spokesperson, girls between 12 and 15 are the most likely to seek help. Last month, the government released its Internet Safety Green Paper, proposing voluntary levies on internet companies such as Google and Facebook to pay for measures to combat and raise awareness of online bullying. This month, it's been revealed that the NHS is cracking down on mental health patients being sent out of their local area. Mental health trusts are being forced as part of an NHS England crackdown to reveal how many patients they're sending elsewhere for treatment because of too few beds. Mental health campaigners have condemned out-of-area placements in which people can be sent hundreds of miles from their home to be treated. Last year alone, almost 6,000 patients in the UK were sent to mental health facilities out of their catchment area. This number is an increase of 40% in the last 2 years. The cost to the NHS has also jumped from £108 million in 2014 and 2015 to £159 million in the last 12 months, an increase of almost 40%. In an interview with the Guardian newspaper, Jeremy Hunt, the UK Health Secretary, said, "No patient should be sent away from their family and friends for treatment where they are seriously unwell. It wouldn't happen with physical health, and we shouldn't accept it for mental health. That's why I'm personally committed to ending the practice by 2020. Finally this week, in another suicide-related story, the Samaritans have released figures this month which show 6,188 suicides were recorded in the UK in 2015, an average of 17 per day. Suicide prevention campaigners have launched a new initiative called Zero Suicide Alliance, with the aim to get specific commitments to reduce suicide deaths and for NHS organisations to aim for zero deaths amongst patients in their care. Steve Mallon, whose 18-year-old son took his own life in 2015, acknowledges there is now a greater awareness of mental health as an issue, but feels there's been little change reflected in frontline NHS services. In Westminster, there is cross-party support for the initiative, whilst the Zero Suicide Alliance's supporters believe suicide is preventable and not inevitable. Thinking about the news stories this week, any suicide is sad. And it's sad for the family and friends of the person involved, but it's especially sad that that person felt so alone, isolated and without any help that they felt they had to take their own life. The Small Talk Saves Lives campaign stresses there's no single sign or behaviour combination that makes a person suicidal and urges passengers on the UK rail network to start a conversation with someone or alert rail staff or the police if they feel something isn't right. So if you travel on the rail network every day and you notice someone who's, well, acting a little bit strange, how would you feel to step in and start a conversation? A conversation that may ultimately stop that person committing suicide. Thinking about the circumstances, it's all about knowing what to look for. 83% of rail passengers said recently they would approach someone who may be suicidal if they knew what signs to look for. Well, these warning signs include a person standing alone, looking distant, or staying on the platform a long time without boarding a train. People should also look out for a person displaying something out of the ordinary in their behaviour or appearance. Ian Stevens, who manages Network Rail's suicide prevention programme, said, "If it were your loved one or friend who was going through an emotional crisis, wouldn't you hope someone took the time to stop and ask if they were okay?" Well, the answer's most definitely yes. Ruth Sutherland is the chief executive of Samaritans, and she says, "Any one of us could have an opportunity to save a life. The stats show that for every life lost on the railway network, six are saved by those around them." Here's the campaign advert by the Samaritans called Small Talk Saves Lives.
"Attention passengers on platform 11. I'm sorry to announce that there's been a serious incident on the line. We know that there was one individual involved. She was 28-year-old Sarah Wilson. Sarah left a note before leaving her house because she had decided to take her own life. But I'm very pleased to tell you, she didn't go through with it because someone took the time to stop and talk to her. That was all it took to interrupt Sarah's suicidal thoughts. I know this because I am Sarah. I'm sharing my story today to spread an important message. That a little small talk can be all it takes to help start someone on a journey to recovery. So if you think someone might need help, trust your instincts. Stop and have a chat. Even a question about the weather can be enough. Or tell a member of staff. You could help save a life."
It's believed 273 people died on the UK rail network in the last 12 months. This is information from the Office of Rail and Road Figures. That said, for every life lost on the railway, as we know, six are saved by those around them. The advert we just heard was not a marketing concept. It is the true story of Sarah Wilson, who was 28 when she decided to take her own life. She said, "Someone talking to me and showing me they cared helped to interrupt my suicidal thoughts and gave them time to subside. The more that people understand that suicide is preventable, the better." You can call the Samaritans free of charge on 116 123. And if you are listening outside of the UK, other international suicide helplines can be found at www.befrienders.org. Also in the news this week, we heard about cyberbullying. Well, last year, Childline delivered 5,103 counselling sessions to children affected by cyberbullying. That's up 12% from the year before. The 24/7 nature of social media means children are not immune to online bullying in the home, and this is having severe consequences on young people's mental health. 14-year-old girl said people who she thought were her friends had edited an Instagram photo to make fun of her. She goes on to say, "I've reported what they're doing and I'm going to delete them on social media. I've spoken to my mum about it, but she just said it's normal for teenagers to do stuff like this. I feel so angry about what's happened." Now, that's an interesting one. A parent saying that this is normal. I'm not sure I could say to my child, actually, being bullied online is normal behaviour. It may be prevalent, but it's not normal. Another girl, also 14, said she was being bullied by a girl at school. She said, she's taken photos of me and posted them on Snapchat, calling me fat, and now I wonder how I will ever have a boyfriend. I've been having suicidal thoughts, as this girl is really popular, and she's turned my whole year against me. A 16-year-old boy told Childline, they're spreading rumours about me and telling me that I should just die. This has been going on for months, but recently they made a Facebook account using my name, and it's getting loads worse. I feel so down all the time. I just want it to stop. Social media really does have that double-edged sword, doesn't it? And this is becoming a sad fact of life. What's your thoughts on cyberbullying? Do you have children who have experienced bullying online? If so, I'd love to hear from you. Contact me on Twitter at Duncan_Ellison or email me at Duncan@thinkduncan.com. Now, under NHS guidelines, patients should be treated in a location which helps them to retain contact with family, friends and carers, and they need to feel as familiar as possible in the local environment. However, chronic bed shortages can make this impossible. Professor Tim Kendall, the NHS Clinical Director for Mental Health, commented, sending acutely unwell people long distances for mental health care causes major distress for people and their families, coupled with the financial costs for the NHS. Ending this practice must be a priority for mental health providers. We heard in the news Jeremy Hunt. He's opposed to these practices and says he makes a personal pledge to stop this by 2020. It's one thing going to hospital. Being admitted to a hospital away from your local catchment area is not going to help you get better. There's the obvious stress. But not only that, your friends and family can't easily come and see you. And that's something that when you're in hospital, you really rely on. To give you an example of how bad the situation was, last year patients from Oxford were sent to Inverness for mental health care. That's 532 miles. Oxford is not remotely close to the Scottish Islands. Others were sent to Aberdeen, 497 miles from Oxford. And patients in Dorset were sent to Darlington in County Durham, which is admittedly much closer at just 323 miles. Kendall also pointed out 54 trusts in the UK have stopped sending mental health patients out of the area. In Sheffield, the NHS has had to pay for more than 3,000 nights of care in a single year by outsourcing to other areas. Simply by looking after their patients within the trust region, it has saved them £5 million. And that's not a little sum of money either. If you remember, we heard from Sean last week, who described his experience of being in a mental health ward. This was 63 miles away from his home, and that was far enough. Imagine being over 300 miles from your family. That's got to be tough. We've heard two suicide stories in the news this week. Whilst it is, as I've said before, incredibly sad that families are affected by this, there is a positive, if you can use that word, a positive movement which has affected families coming forward to not only raise awareness, but also to campaign to reduce this kind of death. We heard one campaigner say suicide is avoidable. But what do you think? Merseycare, a mental health trust in the north of England, is leading the way, having been inspired by a pioneering initiative at the Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, at which suicide was dramatically reduced over a decade to zero. Trust directors have implemented a system whereby every patient is now assessed for suicide risks. Putting this information into numbers, we already know that the Samaritans are aware of 6,188 suicides recorded in the UK in 2015. That is an average of 17 a day, or the equivalent of 20 full-size jumbo jets. That's a big number too. The Zero Suicide Alliance website has a wealth of really good information for you, including where and how to get help if you are having suicidal thoughts, or what to do if you are concerned about someone else. With that in mind, the site also signposts you to a number of other interesting and useful sites, some of which I was aware of, and others which I was not, so I thought I would share some of these with you. CALM, that's the Campaign Against Living Miserably. www.thecalmzone.net. Here's an interesting one. It's called Opening Up Cricket. This is a very cool initiative formed in 2014 to promote well-being and suicide prevention through cricket. www.thecalmzone.net. www.openingupcricket.com. Also, Papyrus, a national charity providing resources to help young people who may have suicidal thoughts. www.papyrus, that's papyrus-uk.org. Back to the Zero Suicide Alliance website. There is not only support for those feeling suicidal, but those who have actually lost family, friends or colleagues. The whole Zero Suicide Alliance website is well worth a look. Prevention goes a long way. We heard earlier about Network Rail's suicide prevention programme. If you remember about Sarah Wilson, she said her life was saved by intervention from a fellow passenger. With a little information, you can have the skills to identify someone who is potentially suicidal. And this website offers free training, which could save a life. www.zerosuicidealliance.com. Wise words later on in the programme, and music still to come from a British band who pioneered three-part harmonies in the 1960s. This week I'd like to focus on PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. We've heard a lot about this mental condition over the last 10 years, especially in relation to servicemen and women who've been affected in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's not just war, though, that contributes to conditions. It can be any traumatic event. Obvious examples include sexual assault and road traffic incidents. We discussed a few weeks ago the emergency service crews who attended the Grenfell fire, many of whom are still now having trauma counselling almost 6 months after the fire. A soldier from the UK Armed Forces shared his experience of PTSD recently with the BBC.
We were on patrol in the desert. Vehicle in our convoy goes over an improvised explosive device, completely destroys the vehicle. I completely froze. My mind was racing. I knew exactly what was going on around me, but I just had absolutely no function over my body whatsoever. And that lasted for a good sort of 10, 15 seconds. After that, I still tried to do my job, so I'd turn my weapon out and try to cover the scene.
A serviceman who is still in the armed forces and has asked us not to use his name. The incident about 18 months ago sent his mind into a state of shock from which it still hasn't fully recovered, not least because of the close friends of his who were caught up in the explosion.
It was hard to believe that anybody could have survived it, but I didn't know until the lads were just putting the body bags onto the helicopter. So that sort of gave me the sinking feeling, but it didn't register properly in my head until after the helicopter had taken off, the dust had cleared, and I stood in the middle of the desert with one of the other lads, and he sort of put his hand on my shoulder and asked me if I was all right, and I just asked him that question, and I was like, right, who was in the bags? And he just sort of told me their names and just went, yes, they're both dead. Yeah, to that point, it sort of sinks in.
He was involved in many other combat incidents, and in one case, his actions in repelling attackers led to him being decorated for bravery. But on returning home to Britain, the war continued to replay in his head, in dramatic flashbacks and nightmares.
I rapidly went downhill, I hit the booze hard, I just locked myself away basically for a week, and I didn't really come out of my bedroom. I couldn't even face my own mum and dad. I got flashbacks, vivid flashbacks, as in there would be something that would trigger me off, so whether it be the news or a car door slamming, like just a bump or something, them little things just, they send your mind off racing, and then all of a sudden you're back there and your heart's racing, you're sweating, you're shaking.
He rarely slept well, and he was eventually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder by forces medics. He went on a course of treatment, but says his condition didn't improve. And he soon learned he had little future in the forces and would be granted a medical discharge.
The PTSD, what I've been diagnosed with, it's a career ender, basically. We all know what happens if you get shot or if you stand on a landmine and stuff like that. That happens, and that's real, but this is also real. This needs to be addressed, and the education throughout the armed forces, right from frontline soldier level right up throughout the ranks, it needs to be hammered home, and it needs to be hammered home sooner rather than later, because this is going to get massive.
But what evidence is there to justify his belief that post-traumatic stress disorder does pose a big health threat to our armed forces?
There are about 30 beds. We have veterans who have come here for treatment. Many of them have found it very difficult to engage with services.
At Tyrwhitt House in Surrey, psychiatrists and therapists have been caring for the mental casualties of war for many years. It's a residential centre run by the veterans charity Combat Stress.
The most dominant condition is post-traumatic stress disorder, so 75% of them have it as a primary diagnosis, and 62% also have disorders including depression and alcohol problems.
Dr. Walter Basuto, the medical director, has noted a steep rise in requests for help from service veterans over the last 5 years. PTSD sufferers often take 10 years or more to seek treatment, but he says Combat Stress has already been contacted by many of those who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan.
In the last year, we've had something like 1,300 new inquiries, people asking for help. Since 2005, this represents a 72% increase in the number of inquiries we've had.
How desperate are some of these people, these veterans, when they come to you?
In some cases, they are very ill indeed. We're seeing severe cases of dissociative post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, in Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans. They lose time, they can't concentrate well, they have blank periods in their memory, and that's really indicative of the kind of high dose of trauma they've been exposed to. They've done their duty by their country, and they've really tried to cope, but for some reason they've broken down.
I mean, some people have talked about a tidal wave of cases, others have talked about an epidemic. How would you characterise it?
Well, I don't think it's an epidemic yet, but it's certainly growing, and it might be an epidemic in about 2 or 3 years. So it would be better to plan services right now.
That's eye-opening stuff, I'm sure you'll agree. Common symptoms of PTSD include disturbing thoughts, feelings and vivid dreams relating to the event. But it must be remembered, everyone is unique. Therefore, everyone will be affected in different ways. Interestingly enough, children are less likely to show distress, but they will express their feelings through play, and that's a good indicator. The term post-traumatic stress disorder is still relatively new. It wasn't until the 1970s, following the Vietnam War, that it became prominent. Before that, the term was much simpler, and one that I'm sure you will have heard and used before yourself: shell-shocked. Amongst other therapies, there are two options that have been proven to reduce PTSD symptoms: CBT, which we've discussed before, and something called exposure therapy. Exposure therapy is quite controversial in the fact that it involves the sufferer reliving trauma-related memories. It's believed facing the memory rather than avoiding it helps the sufferer overcome their fears. I'm just wondering how you would feel if your therapist asked you to relive such a traumatic moment in your life. Do you think facing it head-on will help? Or do you think it's just going to cause more problems? For children, as we heard a few moments ago, who have been exposed to traumatic experiences, play therapy is often the preferred method. A different way of tackling PTSD, and indeed any form of mental illness, is positive exposure to nature. I know some counsellors who take their clients on country walks. Horticultural therapy is an interesting solution which has increased in popularity over the past few years, and this stands to reason. 39% of people in the UK suggest gardening makes them feel healthier, and 79% believe gardening is essential for a quality life. The granddaddy of modern therapy, Sigmund Freud, said, "Flowers are restful to look at. They have neither emotions nor conflicts." Throughout the UK, garden therapy projects have sprouted up charities and organisations such as Growing Space, Grow to Grow, Thrive, Green Fingers and Gardening Leave. The latter provided dedicated support for ex-servicemen and women. Have a listen to Kevin and his support worker talking about using gardening therapy for treating his PTSD.
If I have a flashback or a panic attack or an anxiety attack, there's people here who know what's going on.
It's about building people's confidence with what they can grow and what they can do. And it's about the mindfulness, about getting your hands into the soil and actually feeling the soil, going back to nature, really.
I came here and I was petrified. And I was scared, and when people were talking to me, I'd clam up, I'd hide inside myself. But now I can talk to people and I can have a conversation, and it's lovely, it's magic.
It's also suggested that PTSD affects women who have had an abortion. Some women can also experience it following breast cancer and indeed breast removal. PTSD also can occur following childbirth. At 6 weeks following delivery, it's estimated between 25 and 30% of new mothers could be suffering. Those figures quite shocked me, really. I think they're quite high. What do you think?
My daughter was struggling to breathe and I wasn't strong enough to say anything in that moment, and I don't think I'll ever forgive myself for that.
I finally gave in to an epidural after 19 hours, saying I was not going to have one. There was absolutely no way. The epidural failed.
My body just totally shut down.
It was 3.5 litres of blood that I lost.
I felt really disconnected from my baby in the beginning and really alienated. I felt that I couldn't talk about it when everybody was coming round to see my beautiful, healthy baby.
I just sort of muddled along for a while, because if you don't know what it is, then it must just be motherhood.
Sort of over 6 weeks, my life just fell apart. I just was terrified.
Still now, 2 years after, I still feel quite fragmented about it.
It was like my brain was coming up with the worst possible thing, the most frightening thing, the most distressing thing for me, and just torturing me with it.
I know myself, I know what my feelings are, and I just knew it was something more than, you know, normal hormonal baby blues.
People had spoken to me about postnatal depression, and I knew that this wasn't depression.
I just felt so unsafe.
I would sit at the top of the stairs crying, and my 2-year-old son would come and sit next to me and put his little arm around me and tell me it's going to be okay, mummy. That was the moment I was like, no, we need to get on top of this, we need to sort this out.
I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, and then my world came crashing down because suddenly it all made sense.
I didn't know what it was. I didn't know you could get PTSD from childbirth.
Post-traumatic stress can be experienced by one partner or both. Actually, the implications of it are far-reaching.
I mean, certainly there is a cultural thing of a healthy baby is all that matters, and that's not true. You know, you matter, actually.
I felt, was I over-dramatising it? Was it as significant as I thought it was?
A lot of women can feel that they don't have a place to talk about their birth experience if their baby's healthy, because so many women don't have a healthy baby.
And then just feeling so guilty that my brain was distracted thinking about all these thoughts when I had a beautiful little girl in my arms.
The statistics show that actually it's a really small minority of people that do manage to give birth without any sort of assistance at all.
I mean, I thought I was going to play Scrabble and listen to Franz Ferdinand take me out.
There is no right birth. There is no perfect journey.
The experience of giving birth is life-changing. Even if we have a really easy birth, it's life-changing, and I think we need to talk about it more.
Your feelings about your birth experience are valid.
We're grown women. You know, we often can accept and understand that there are lots of different scenarios. And I think a lot of the time in society, we're afraid of letting first-time mums know what they may experience. And so often women feel really in the dark, and then they can feel quite angry later if they don't have the birth that they wish to have.
I just feel like people should just be more honesty about the whole thing. And it shouldn't be this taboo subject.
More dialogue around birth and more acceptance that any kind of birth that you have is an okay birth.
Here in the UK, there is a dedicated charity to raising awareness and helping those suffering with PTSD. The organisation is PTSD UK. You can check them out yourself at www.ptsduk.org. One thing I found amazing is their incredibly simple solution to help sufferers. It is so simple that you'll never guess what it is. It's not therapy, and it's not medication. It's a weighted blanket. A weighted blanket not only helps those with PTSD, but also people suffering from anxiety, stress, insomnia, and many other conditions. This is particularly crucial for those suffering from PTSD who may find themselves experiencing overtiredness, hypervigilance, and raised cortisol levels at bedtime. It sounds like a very simple method of helping people, but studies have shown weighted blankets really do work. It connects with an idea known as deep pressure touch stimulation, DPTS. Which is a form of therapy in itself. It involves pressure being exerted over the body in order to tap into the psychological and physical benefits. This type of pressure could come from touching, stroking, holding and swaddling, and can be relaxing and calming. It could also come from, you guessed it, weighted blankets. Occupational therapist Karen Moore explained to the PTSD Journal, "In psychiatric care, weighted blankets are one of our most powerful tools for helping people who are anxious, upset, and possibly on the verge of losing control. It strikes me as such a simple solution. It works by moulding your body like a big, comforting hug. With the pressure applied to your body, your nervous system will then start to relax. This helps to naturally initiate sleep and relaxation without the need for any drug interventions. It gives their body a chance to recoup and recover without disturbances. Not only does a weighted blanket calm your nervous system and provide a feeling of comfort, but the pressure of a weighted blanket also helps to encourage serotonin production. Serotonin is a chemical in the brain that is responsible for improving our mood, which is essential for helping people start to feel calm and reassured. It also serves to decrease cortisol levels, all without ever needing a doctor's prescription." Fantastic! In 2006, a study into the safety and therapeutic effects of weighted blankets discovered 78% of people preferred using the weighted blankets as a way of calming them down, and 33% demonstrated lower electrodermal activity. This was backed by a 2012 report published in Australia, which also found that weighted blankets definitely decreased visible signs of anxiety and stress.
Riding along on a carousel, trying to catch up to you. Riding along on a carousel, will I catch up to you? Horses chasing, cause they're racing, so near, so far. On a carousel, on a carousel, nearer, nearer by changing horses, still so far away. People fighting for
Before we move on, if you have a mental health story to tell, whether it's your journey or someone close to you, or if you run a mental health project, do get in touch, either on Twitter, @Duncan_Ellison, or email Duncan@thinkduncan.com. I'd really like to hear from you. This is UK Health Radio. Hello, my name's Duncan, and I'll be with you each week to put a new twist on mental health. If you like this show and want more, you can listen to all of the different programmes on UK Health Radio. You can choose the live play schedule or download your favourite programme on demand, wherever and whenever you need to. This has really been an emotive programme to put together this week. We've discussed quite a lot about suicide. We've also explored the different forms of PTSD. Mental health, as we've discussed before, is very subjective. And whilst I try to bring you the facts, I also try to look for the positive message. The feedback I've had from you and the support I've had through the Twitter feed has been amazing. And I believe, I really do, together we are stronger and in a great position to inform and educate about positive mental health. No matter what our circumstances, we all have a common thread. And sadly, that thread is death. We have no control over it. And one thing is certain, bereavement is a bitter experience. In a counselling environment, bereavement is a subject that we deal with a lot. Or at least we attempt to walk in the same shoes as the client as they make sense of the situation they're experiencing. The reality is, there's no technique to fix the gap which death presents. A counsellor relies on the core conditions that we discussed last week: empathy, congruence, and unconditional positive regard to ease the client through their mournful feelings, and hopefully into a position of acceptance. With that in mind, on this week's Toolbox Talk, I want to share with you the five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. The five stages of grief was a model created in the late 60s by a Swiss psychiatrist named Elisabeth Kubler-Ross. Motivated by the lack of instruction regarding death, and inspired by her work with terminally ill patients, she examined death and studied those faced with it. Kubler-Ross noted some years after the release of her model that the stages are not simply linear and predictable in progression. Moreover, a collation of five common experiences which can occur at any time and in any order. I really did think long and hard how best to illustrate such a sensitive subject. You can look online and learn more for yourself about Kubler-Ross. There are plenty of videos on YouTube, and whilst informative, by definition they are, well, quite sad. I then thought one of the online tutorials outlining the five stages of grief could convey my thoughts on the subject, but it just didn't feel right. After a lot of thought, I had a light bulb moment. Why not approach this from a different angle? So how do Disney Pixar normalise mental health in their films? Here's how. Let's take the 2009 Disney Pixar animation Up. Whilst it tugs at the heartstrings, it has a light-hearted look at life, and this film conveys the five stages of grief model. If you haven't seen it, my suggestion is do so. Very quickly, here's the plot, and I think you'll see how everything ties in together. The film starts with 9-year-old Carl, who idolises a famous explorer and befriends a girl called Ellie, who shares a common interest in exploration. Carl and Ellie grow up together and get married. Sadly, Ellie suffers from a miscarriage and the couple are told they will never have children. So they focus their time and money saving for an exciting trip away, something they've always dreamed about. But when Carl arranges the trip, Ellie sadly passes away. Years pass, and Carl still lives in the same home he and Ellie shared, but the neighbourhood is being demolished to make way for skyscrapers. When he accidentally injures a construction worker, the court deems him a public menace and orders him to move into a retirement home. However, Carl keeps his promise to Ellie and turns his house into a makeshift airship using thousands of balloons. Russell is a young scout, and he visits Carl in an effort to earn his merit badge for assisting the elderly. And just as the house lifts off, he becomes an accidental stowaway. There, the adventure together begins. So let's look how the five stages of grief are illustrated in the family favourite film. Stage 1, denial. Carl refuses to accept Ellie is gone and is no longer part of his life. Living in the same house suggests he's unable to move on. He becomes recluse and is unable to make a new relationship after his wife's death. This is common for people stuck in this stage, as they are unable or simply don't want to deal with their feelings. Stage 2, anger. Carl protects his house and tries to keep it in the same condition as when he and his wife were alive together. As soon as someone, and in this case the construction team, attempts to demolish the house, he lashes out and injures the construction worker. Carl does not want to move on, so resorts to anger to protect his house and his memories. Stage 3, bargaining. By exploring the world in his house come airship, he attempts to ease the pain. He believes the adventure will fill the void left by Ellie. Stage 4, depression. Instead of allowing himself to feel sad after the death of Ellie, Carl chooses anger to hide his true feelings. When his exploration does not go as planned, he feels like he has let his wife down, as it was their dream to explore. He now feels he cannot maintain his promise to her. And finally, stage 5, acceptance. Throughout the film, we see a mostly withdrawn husband missing his wife. Toward the end of the film, he finds a note in his wife's scrapbook thanking him for the adventures and the joy he has given her. There is a footnote wishing him to go on and explore the world without her. This is the moment of acceptance and the moment of change. Carl embraces the warm feelings of desire he and his wife shared and accepts that he needs to move on with new people like Russell in his life. This film offers a sweet perspective on what is, ultimately, a sad story of grief and loss. Carl, as a loving soulmate and as a bereaved husband, must continue on his journey without the one true person he loves. And that journey is symbolised in his later life adventure, which you could say is a metaphor for the five stages of grief. We're coming towards the end of the programme, so let's finish with wise words. This week, accept yourself, love yourself, and keep yourself moving forward. If you want to fly, first, you have to rid yourself of what is weighing you down. Don't forget, if you do have any mental health concerns or have been affected by anything raised on today's programme, please consult your GP or find a counselling service to talk to. You've been listening to The Therapy Suite with me, Duncan Ellison, only on UK Health Radio. Stay well and keep smiling.